reading from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, chapter 3, text 10. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Tasya Pasanta Vahita Samskara. The mind's undisturbed flow occurs due to samskaras. When one becomes proficient in cultivating the restraining samskaras, say the commentators, the mind can then flow peacefully in meditation without disturbance. Prashanta Vahita, that is, without being dictated by outgoing samskaras. Or as Shankara puts it, meditative absorption lasts for as long as the remaining samskaras are not overcome by outgoing samskaras. It's important to note that the restraining samskaras in actuality a continuous series of samskaras. As we've discussed further below, the restraining or any type of samskaras are actually an ongoing sequence of similar samskaras. Like a movie reel of identical stills, nothing is static. Even in deep meditation, a continuous sequence of restraining samskaras is in motion in the controlled mind. Hence, Patanjali used the term flow, vahita, in this sutra. Okay. Come in. You're going to listen?
Yeah.
Okay.
No?
No, you're more than welcome. This is about yoga.
Okay,
let's see. Okay, we'll just bring us up to where we are. So the chapter is on mystic powers. And in the chapter on mystic powers, it begins with the last three limbs of Ashtanga Yoga. Even though the second chapter is practice, it makes kind of sense in one sense, because the first chapter is meditative absorption, and the second chapter is practice, how to attain meditative absorption. And so in one sense, the dharana, dhyan, and samadhi, and then it describes the two ways in which you can attain meditative absorption, kriya yoga and ashtanga yoga. But it also makes sense in one sense, because when it describes the practice of Ashtanga Yoga to attain meditative absorption, the last three limbs are the platform of meditative absorption. So maybe that's perhaps one reason it's described in the third chapter, Mystic Powers. But also, the mystic powers are created by samyama, by the deep absorption that comes from dharana, dhyana, samadhi on different aspects of the gross and subtle body. So the chapter began discussing dharana, dhyana, samadhi. We described that the difference is only in level of maturity. And the platform of dharana, commentators describe it as like a faucet where it's kind of dripping. The remembrance is there. One is detached from the pratyahara, has already been passed. One is detached himself from the senses. but yet the meditation is not yet at full acceleration. And then there is dhyana, that's described like a faucet flowing or oil flowing. It's continuous. And at that stage, even if there are objects of attachment, it's unlikely that the mind will be disturbed. Well, at the platform of dharana, in the presence of objects of attachment, there's greater, much greater chance to be allured externally. And then the platform of samadhi was described. It's described as sarupa shunyam, that it's devoid of its own reflective nature. This is the school of yoga. That there's threefold objects of knowledge. There's the object itself, there's the name of the object, the idea of the object. So in samadhi, the commentators just describe that the idea and the name of the object is not the meditation, but the object itself. Sometimes the example is given of a pure crystal reflecting a red flower, then the crystal becomes red. So in this level of meditation, the mind itself becomes the object of meditation. And then it describes the concept of samyama, which means dharana, dhyan, samadhi. And it's described that it's generally progressive. It's almost like one is taking a picture and you focus, you know, the focus becomes more intense. You don't start from focus. Every time that you take a picture, even though you become very, very expert at focus, you don't start from focus. You start from something else and you come to focus. So then rather than each time the process comes up, mention dharana, dhyan, samadhi. There's just one word for it, samyama. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it properly, but because it's going to become a meditation that one enters into and focuses. You know, you don't start of that level of the void of its own reflective nature. Even if every time the yogi goes into meditation, he starts with a conception, an idea of his reflective nature. He starts with an idea of the name of the object, the idea of the object. But by his intense ability to concentrate, he comes maybe quickly to that point. So these are described that they're progressive stages. It goes one after another. But he also interestingly mentioned exceptions. And the exception is, if one has attained some level in his last life, then if he's attained some level in his last life, then he may not, you know, go progressively on the different limbs and just go into a state of meditation. The example was given of Bhart Maharaj from his last life. He had attained a very, very high level of meditation and absorption and somehow deviated from that. But in his next two lives, he carried that. And therefore, in the third life after Bhart Maharaj, when he was Jada Bhart, he was just automatically very advanced. But generally, it's a progression. And it also shows that the real yoga is the meditation itself, because that's the goal of the other limbs, that's the goal of asana, that's the goal of pranayama. But because the meditation can be, well, there are exceptions where the meditation can be achieved without the going progressively to the other limbs, it really shows that the object of yoga is this meditation. And yeah, so and from this type of meditation, samyama, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, when one is detached from the senses, his meditation is very internal. It says an insight comes, and what is insight? Insight is the clear distinction between the soul and the body and the mind. So naturally, at this particular stage of focus and concentration, when one easily comes to the platform of goodness, where the senses become illumined, where one's discrimination becomes sharp, then automatically from this level of meditation, where the fluctuations of the mind are controlled, the instrument of the mind rapidly and quickly, because the mind is always in flux, rapidly and quickly comes into its natural state of like a mirror, again distorted, when a mirror comes to its natural state, it's reflected. So it comes to its natural state of reflection. And then it described that even these three dharana, dhyan, and samadhi are external to seedless samadhi. And seedless, what does it mean? A near beach, where your meditation is not dependent on the mind at all. That somehow or other one becomes completely self-reflective. And that was described in the first chapter. When one comes to the point of self-reflective, then even dharana and dhyana are, and sub-ij samadhi, where the samadhi is based on the instrument of the mind, even those become external to that platform. And then finally, before we get to today's verse, nirodha was defined, and it's defined as this kind of, because the modes, the nature of the modes, it's always in our flux. So it's not exactly a stillness, but Patanjali describes it as an appearance of restraining samadhis and a disappearance of outgoing samskaras and a disappearance of outgoing samskaras. So when the impressions, the attachments in the mind, pronunciation and restraint become so powerful that they can subdue the samskaras of enjoyment, the samskaras of externalizing one's consciousness to enjoy the world. When the appearance of the restraining samskaras becomes so powerful that the samskaras to enjoy the world and to move outward are completely subdued, that's called nirodha. And it's very interesting to be described here. It's described as the mind is made of samskaras, and Vyas, following Patanjali in this sutra, divides these into two basic types, vyutana, outgoing samskaras that propel the mind into any kind of activity, and the nirodha, restraining samskaras, which are activated in meditation and restrain the outgoing samskaras. Patanjali is now providing more detailed and subtle information as to the mechanics underpinning the state of chitta-vritti nirodha that he establishes the goal of yoga. Specifically, nirodha is attained by nirodha samskaras. According to the psychology of samadhi, when the yogi sets about meditating, What actually is occurring is that a restraining Nirodha set of samskaras, restraining samskaras, is being cultivated to suppress the normal flow of mundane outgoing vyutana samskaras active in the turmoil of everyday thought. Thus, when the mind is active and roaming about as a normal consciousness, the restraining samskaras are latent and therefore absent. And when the restraining samskaras are active and dominant, the outgoing ones are being suppressed. The idea is that there is always an ongoing dynamic between these two, and therefore, even when the mind is restrained in meditation, there is a tussle between the restraining samskaras and the others, and consequently ongoing movement, although imperceptible to the meditator. In other words, on a metaphysical level, there is always movement in prakriti, however subtle, even when the mind appears to be completely restrained and fixed in the higher stages of sub-bij samadhi. So, at every moment of meditation, there is suppression of the latent outgoing samskaras and strengthening of the restraining samskaras that are performing this task of suppression. So, okay, and now text 10, we'll the mind's undisturbed flow occurs tasya prasanta vahita samskara, due to samskaras. When one becomes proficient in cultivating the restraining samskaras, says the commentators, the mind can then flow peacefully in meditation without disturbance. Prasanta vahita, that is, without being distracted by outgoing samskaras. Contrarily, when these restraining samskaras become weakened, they are overpowered by the outgoing samskaras. Or as Shankara puts it, meditative absorption lasts for as long as the remaining samskaras are not overcome by outgoing samskaras. So your meditation lasts as long as your restraining samskaras, your attachment for renunciation, your attachment for restraint that is being brought to the prominence in the consciousness is not overcome by the outgoing samskara. There's something here too that I found relevant to meditation that it's just one thought after another. And what meditation means is that when the same thought precedes the following one. In other words, if you're meditating on the Hare Krishna mantra, then meditation and concentration and restraint of the outgoing samskaras is achieved when you're chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, and the next thought is the Hare Krishna mantra, and the next thought is the Hare Krishna mantra, and the next thought is the Hare Krishna mantra. But if it's the Hare Krishna mantra and then you think of your work, it's the Hare Krishna mantra, you think of your romance, it's the Hare Krishna mantra, and then the next thought is your business or work or family, then that's not concentration, and that's not meditation. Real meditation comes when you're hearing very, very carefully the syllables of the mantra. Therefore, sometimes I like to chant two mantras at once consciously, just to make sure that I'm in that kind of progression without any other thoughts, just at least to make sure that one mantra follows the other. So just concentrating just to chant one mantra and then another mantra, and then start again, one mantra and another mantra, just so that there's no intermittent thoughts, because then that's not yoga. And even from a mechanical point, unless some level of absorption is attained, it's not going to have the dynamic to bring the mind to goodness and quell the samskara, which a devotee also wants to attain. because goodness is the platform by which one can transcend. So it's not exactly we're just trying to meditate and just maneuver the mind. There's something more when you actually chant devotionally the names of God. There's a little something more than just that. It's an inspiration to the soul. It's samskaras of devotion that pervade the thoughts of the consciousness. Here it says, it is important to note that restraining samskaras are in actuality a continuous series of samskaras. As was be discussed further below, the restraining of any type of samskara is actually an ongoing experience of similar samskaras, like a movie reel of identical stills. Even in deep meditation, a continuous sequence of restraining samskaras is in motion in the controlled mind. Hence the term flow. That the mind has an undisturbed flow. It means, from two perspectives, either there's a flow of that object. It's like a movie reel with the same object. You're meditating. So if you're meditating on Ishvara, meditating on the Supreme Lord, which is designated by different mantras, then it has to be a continuous flow. The attainment of samadhi involves the elimination of all pointedness, wandering of the mind, and the rise of one pointedness, concentration. So there's two states of mind basically described here. Very, very practically, there's all pointedness. There's a state of mind where the mind is just thinking of just so many things. And then there is one pointedness where the mind is fixed on one thing. So samadhi arises when the concentration on one thing reaches its highest potential. And when the concentration on one thing reaches its highest potential, then the wandering of the mind, which is described here as sarva artata, focused on all objects as opposed to eka agateo, focused on one object. Focused on all objects is restlessness. The mind is wandering. So samadhi means when this eka agratio, the one object the mind becomes focused on that completely, and therefore the mind stops wandering. And when that concentration reaches its highest point, and then described here in samadhi, at least in the yoga school, I'm not speaking a particular dogma or a particular opinion, I'm just saying what this particular school states. So when you reach that samadhi, then the reflective nature is given up. One is not conscious of himself. He's not conscious of the name of the object, the idea of the object. He's just experiencing the object. And when it reaches its highest point of just that object, the thought of that object is just continuous and follows in that highest point, that's samadhi. Vyasa notes that the nature of the mind is to be all pointed, sarva artha, that is scattered and roaming about anywhere and everywhere, and thinking of all manners of random things. In normal consciousness, the propensity of the mind is ever restless and always thinking about sense objects, the past and future, worrying about this and that. However, the mind also has an inherent potential of being one-pointed, eka agata, or fixed on one object. When the later propensity is developed to its highest potential, the state of samadhi is attained. Vachaspati mind says that nothing is ever destroyed. When one of these propensities of the mind arises, that is, when one set of samskara is discussed, and the last verse activates, the other propensity remains latent. So 12. Tathapuna shanto dito tulya pratyayo chitasya kagrita parinama. In that regard, the attainment of one pointness occurs when the image in the mind just passed is the same as the image in the mind that is present. So one pointness means when the object, the image of the image attained in the mind is past, then the present image is the same as that. So it's like a movie reel with the same object, the same thought, again and again. I'm meditating on Om, and then when that thought goes, then the next thought is Om, and then Om, 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 or chanting whatever mantra one states. When one says that the mind is one point at a fix, Eka Agrata state the comment that was actually meant is that the previous cognition or image in the mind that is subsided is identical to the cognition or image that succeeds it. That's one pointedness. That the image in the past is the same as the image that has now come. And when the image that has now come is past, the image that one has in the present is same as that. This underscores the fact that the mind is never static, but always flowing. Concentration involves replacing a previous mental image with the same image, and so on in an ongoing series. This is like the role of the same identical image on the consecutive slides of a movie reel, therefore producing what appears to be a static picture, but in actuality a flow of identical but separate momentary images. So if you had just one image on a film, and you played the film with the same exact image, even though there's one image following another, the impression that one would get is that there's just one static image. It's a beautiful analogy of how the mind is in flux, but by meditation, by keeping constant in the mind the thought of one object, how it appears that the mind is just static. One might object that this constant change of one image by another, although identical image, during meditation nonetheless means that the mind is in reality not actually fixed and unmoving at all. So one can claim that this is not actually Eka Agrita, because there's one image and another, and therefore the mind is not actually fixed. So Ramananda Saraswati says these momentary images are constantly succeeding another and thus coming and going in constant moving. This is technically correct. When we say the mind is fixed in samadhi, we are being rhetorical. What this actually means is that in meditation, the constant movement of the mind is focused on the same image. It is one point that, while during normal consciousness, the constant movement of the mind can randomly flit about and temporarily focus on anything at any given moment. As noted above, everything in Prakriti, including the mind, is constantly in motion, a flux by their very nature. Technically, it is rajas that impels movement. Both sattva and tamas are quiescent. It means like quieted, I guess, quiescent by nature. Without rajas, there would be no motion in anything but prakriti. Indeed, there would be no things emerging from prakriti in the first place, since there would be no impetus to stir prakriti into emergence. Since rajas is inherent in the very nature of prakriti, everything is in constant motion once creation has been set in motion. Hence, meditation is about keeping a flow of samskaras fixed on an object, rather than the state of actual ontological stillness. Additionally, the Gandhiksha does well to point out that while yoga is defined as chitta vritti nirodha, technically speaking, this entails all vrittis other than the one solitary stable vritti containing the object of concentration. So, that's about, I know it's a very short class today, but somehow that's about what I'm up to now. I'm also, what the section that's coming up now is mystic powers. I may just briefly enter into that to show devotees how that works, but I'm not sure. In other words, it says by performing samyama, this dharana, dhyana, samadhi on different parts of the body, there are different transformations of the elements of the body that create extraordinary bodily phenomena. Like if you concentrate on the outer form of the body, invisibility is attained. This occurs when perceptibility is obstructed by blocking contact between light and eyes. So once you get into this samyama, this kind, you know, you can meditate on different parts of the body, and there's a natural reorganization of elements that produces some kind of wonderful effect. So I'm not sure how much it is that we're going to actually have to study that, but we'll do some of it, because this samyama on the pit of the throat, hunger and thirst is gone. On the light of the skill, you see perfected beings. On the subtle tortoise channel, steadiness is attained. On the heart, knowledge of the mind comes. When I was in India, there was one student, I remember his name, Narayan Gautam. He was from a Brahmin family in Nepal. And our Sanskrit teacher went to visit the father, who was a Ayurvedic doctor. And he, according to the Sanskrit pandit, had perfected something called Swarshastra. It's regulating the breath. And it gave him some ability to read the future. And he became so perceptive that, according to the Sanskrit teacher, he would have the medicine prepared before the patient came. So there's different mystic powers when you understand metaphysics of Sankhya, how the underpinnings of the material nature work. Then within the frame of this metaphysics, then so many incredible things are possible. Are there any questions? Anybody like to say hello?
Hare Krishna.
Yeah, Hare Krishna. I needed someone at the beginning to encourage me. I needed someone at the beginning to say hello. But yeah, what is it?
Oh, yeah, I don't know how much time we have, but I did have two questions.
Please ask your two questions.
Yeah, the first one was, you know, even if a person doesn't know anything about Krishna, this scientific process of meditation should work for understanding at least that one is not the body, that one is spirit soul, right?
Yeah, there would be some realization of that,
anyway.
But I do believe that the Buddhists, I don't think they believe in the soul. So I'm not sure. They also meditate. I'm not sure what they experience, but you certainly get, it's certainly, you experience something, but how you label it and how you understand it, there may be some knowledge first. I mean that you ascribe something to, because people do come to different conclusions. But I assume that the experience is basically the same, and it does not matter what your theistic conception is, because the yogic practice, although worship of God is recommended in some parts, the psychosomatic process of how the mind works by meditation does bring one to a point of clear insight. And clear insight means to see what exists, and to see what exists means to see the distinction between matter and spirit. So, yes, it's independent of any theological concept, yes.
Okay, so my question, though, is that you can attain this, you know, discrimination,
yeah,
by, you know, it's like it doesn't, as long as your focus is one-pointed, it doesn't,
yeah,
matter. Isn't it true that it doesn't matter?
It doesn't
what
matter,
that
right,
object of focus is. And so,
it doesn't, no.
But
it's
wondering,
harder.
I mean, I still have a doubt, though, because I'm thinking if...
But it's
if
more
your object
difficult.
Of excuse me?
But it's more difficult when the object of meditation is just a meditational prop and doesn't have the power to intervene in the modes of material nature to help you in your perfection. In other,
yeah,
words, when you,
mm-hmm,
when you actually are meditating on God, then the object of your meditation has potency, and by that meditation, you can invoke the potency of the object of meditation to assist you in your perfection. Because when you actually,
right,
study, as you're studying the samadhi, it's so subtle, and the levels and depth of concentration are so profound, it's really, really hard to imagine people being able to do that. I mean, I remember, I think it was Borijan or Satchinandana Swami or something, you know, they were, I'm not sure who it was, but they were up in Varsana, and there was a devotional yogi that was passing there, and he was just all day meditating. He was like a yogi sitting up, but I think he was chanting, but all day. He had no interest in talking or anything. So I guess by hard work, life after life, proper samskaras, people can achieve a high level of meditation, meditative absorption. But it's not dependent on worshiping God. The object of meditation literally can be anything, and it will work.
Right. But now,
it's very difficult.
Yeah. But what if the prop is not as benign as, say, a candle? What if the prop is, you know, a desire, like, you know, a desire in the modes, you know, like in the lower modes, you know, I want revenge on somebody, and that's the only thing in my consciousness, or I want this, you know, or I want a relationship, that's the only thing in my consciousness, you know, what if it's something like that, not something like so neutral? I mean, if one-pointedness is what is the key, then what would be so bad about those kinds of thoughts?
Because they're thoughts of ignorance, and they're thoughts that bring this mind to the senses as opposed to just meditating on something. Now you're saying, what about if the meditation is revenge, you know, and hate? You know, it's such a desire to contact the senses and externalize. So it's actually a meditation that I am the body, I am the mind. So I guess there was three meditations here. One, it's just neutral, it's just a candle. There's, you know, you ascribe nothing to it, and hopefully for the yogi in his meditation. Now, I should describe, this is much different from Gaudiya Vedanta in terms of meditation. You don't try to get rid of the idea or the name. In fact, we chant the name of the object, and we feel the name is not different than the object. But, right, so, you know, so you think if someone, you know, tries to become, he forgets himself, he forgets the object, he forgets the name, what's he left with? Just the object. So what you'd be meditating on anyway, if you actually perfected it, is you wouldn't be meditating with any emotion of revenge, you'd just be meditating on a person. So, you know, you'd just be meditating on a person, and that would be Eka Agrata, that person, that person, that person. But once you go to that person and feelings of hate for that person, you're already a step removed from meditation.
So the idea is to focus on something that does not encourage you to come to the senses.
We do have the example, though, of Shishupal.
Yeah.
Who's meditating on Krishna out of hate. But his object was potent.
Helping him.
Yeah, it was potent and actually purifying him.
Yeah.
Okay, so what was your last question, Gail?
Yeah, can you just explain what you mean by the senses get illumined and when that happens? You know?
Senses get illumined are a symptom of the mode of goodness, and it's called prakash, and prakash means light. It kind of means, let's say you're in a room and you're trying to look at a book, and there's hardly any light, then you can't see the pages. Right? You can't see the pages if the light's not good and the print is small. But if you turn on the light very brightly, then you see the page. So the analogy is whatever happens in the mode of goodness, you get clarity of sensual perception. You can smell things distinctly. You can hear things distinctly. You can see things distinctly. And hopefully that level of discrimination, discriminative discernment, brings you to a platform where you see clearly the difference between the body and the soul. In other words, there's higher and higher levels of discernment. Even you meditate on an object, and then beyond the object you can meditate on the, you know, the elements of the object. There's the object, it's water, but then there's H2O, there's ice. But behind the ice, there's water. Behind the water, there's H2O. And the H2O is made of prakriti. So your meditation can get more and more subtle, more and more distinct. So that's what it means. It means when there's light coming through the senses, the perception is more clear. So it goes through sensual perceptions and more clear, and intellectual discernment is more clear. Right now, what is our perception? We do not see the soul different than the body. Mm-hmm. We're not able, it's very fuzzy. So when you have light, just imagine you can shine a light on the body and see consciousness and the body separate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah, and so I wouldn't even see an ordinary apple in the same way that I see it now.
According to yoga, you wouldn't. According to any perspective, you wouldn't. According to the bhakti perspective, you would, you know, if you're not a devotee, you'd see the apple as material. You'd see no you'd see no connection with God, and you would claim possessiveness of it. Now, and another thing, if you saw the apple, and you're theistic, you see the apple as God's energy, and you see it as meant for His service. So it's a completely different perception. But even in a yogic perception, you meditate on an apple, let's say, and at higher conceptions, you forget yourself, you forget the idea of the apple, you forget the name of the apple, and it would just be the apple. Just the red flowers reflected in the crystal is completely red. So your consciousness would just be this object. And by that one samskara, you would be able to subdue the other samskaras. So there's sarva agrata, you're meditating on everything that comes up, and there's one thing. So as we know in yoga, even that one thing eventually has to be transcended. If one wants to abide in the soul, therefore there's nirbij and subbij samadhi. Subbij samadhi is you're still meditating through the instrument of the mind. And then the higher stage of meditation here is the abiding, you're living, dwelling in your own nature. Okay, Gail?
Okay.
Okay? Okay, is there anybody else like to say hello? Okay, while I'm waiting for someone to say hello, I am thinking of changing class, and Wednesday night is kind of difficult for me sometimes because I'm in different places, I'm in different countries, and sometimes I'm preaching, sometimes I'm just fatigued at night. Probably, I don't know, in a month or so, I'm going to try to switch over to maybe an hour earlier. A lot of people now. I started this at 9 o'clock because cell phones were free, but now a lot of people have unlimited minutes or they have plans on their telephones, so I think I could move it up. It's certainly easier for me. I'm in Central Time, so it's 8 o'clock here. I don't know what I would do if I'd have to start the class at 9. And then what I'm thinking, because I'm not always there and I want something dynamic, I may co-teach a class with Mahamuni, where I probably will do something on Bhagavad Gita initially, a kind of a perspective on Bhagavad Gita, where we can both speak and discuss the points, and then perhaps, you know, when I'm not there, then he can speak, or when he's not there, I can speak. I was thinking, should I give up this Wednesday class? But it's gone for 3.5 years, so I'm thinking of, I just saw Mahamuni today because I'm staying in greetings from Austin, Texas. So I'm thinking of different ways to do it. Anybody else like to say hello? One more person say hello? Okay, I can understand that this class is running its course. But I'm hearing people, because I'm hearing people in the background. Let me see if I can see who it is. Okay, I'm satisfied. Vanchakalpa Thurubhya Shakapa Sindhu Vyavacha Patitanam Bhavanayoga.